The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network. Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, Nerdapalooza, the world's largest nerd music festival, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other fine Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
This is Dan Aykroyd, happy to be on the Nerdy Show.
Welcome to Nerdy Show, a weekly podcast dedicated to every facet of nerddom. From comics and video games to science and technology, if it's geeky, we've got it covered. I'm Cap, and this is a slightly irregular episode of Nerdy Show. It's a Microsode 2-pack. Microsodes are where you, the listener, give us a topic for us to talk about for 15 to 30 minutes. So this episode, we've got two Microsodes smashed together like some kind of a sexy info hamburger. We're going to be talking about James Bond, specifically the multiple Bond theory, and how the movies may or may not work together in continuity. We're also going to be talking about Howard Philip Lovecraft, yes, H.P. Lovecraft, the master of 20th century horror, a man whose career was in relative obscurity, except for those of the nerdiest pursuits, but in the later part of last century, well, he's become about as well-known as Nikola Tesla. So you may be asking yourself a couple questions now, maybe, well, gee, how can I get a Microsode? Or, I know about how Microsodes are made. It's when mommy and daddy love each other very much. Why is this happening now? Why me? Will they love the baby more than they'll love me? And I have answers for you. Well, we're a listener-funded podcast, and in addition to sending people perks in the mail, every consecutive $100 mark that we reach in a monthly support drive, the person who pushes us over that $100 mark, they earn a Microsode. You choose a topic for us to talk about, and if you so wish, select which hosts you'd like to cover the topic or lead the discussion. And as for why now and what's going on, well, things are getting really busy for Nerdy Show. We haven't actually put out a Nerdy Show Microsode since we relaunched Nerdy Show and launched the new website a few months ago. We had a plan initially to put them out every Saturday or every other Saturday as sort of a fun, short weekend podcast thing. Unfortunately, it turned out we didn't actually have the resources to pull that off. So we thought to ourselves, well, we'll keep recording Microsodes, which we have been, and we'll figure out some clever way to put them out. We thought, okay, well, when we're going to relaunch Microsodes, we'll do a big episode that's maybe like three or four Microsodes stuck together. And be like, here's a bunch of Microsodes and they're awesome, and here's information on when we're going to put out more Microsodes. But unfortunately, that day has not come yet. Something a little bigger came up, and I don't think you'll have any objections. This week, the Dungeons & Doritos Book 2 finale is coming out. I know, it's been a long time coming. We're all really sorry about that. Suffice it to say, we're never going to create a situation for ourselves in which we'll have to have so many people recording an episode all at once. It was a scheduling nightmare, and there were some acts of God and other unforeseen chaos thrown in our way. But the important part is, it's done, it's great, it's got an original score, as always, done by the D&D music crew. Both Steve O'Bortz, aka Level 99 from Overclocked After Dark and Overclocked Remix, Ryan McQuinn, and this episode for the first time, Kyle, aka Shinobi MC, is joining the crew and adding to the brand new score of this episode. In addition to that, we'll have a Nerdy Show book club coming up next week. So if you haven't finished Neuromancer yet, you totally should. And that's not all, there's a lot more. As you may know, we've got some pretty serious E3 coverage every year, and we're getting things kicked off a little early thanks to Microsoft's press conference that's happening this week, where they're announcing details on the next Xbox. If all goes according to plan, we'll be hosting a live stream where you can watch the announcement along with us and find out our reactions live as they unveil whatever the hell they're going to unveil about the new system. You should check nerdyshow.com/E3 for any details on that. Pretty sure it's going to happen, but we're still finalizing our setup. However, what you can expect is that when it comes to the actual press conferences at E3 in Los Angeles, we'll have more interactive things set up, possibly including our own feeds from some of the events, and you can watch that unfold with us and chat along with us. But also this week, also, is our long-awaited Kyle McLaughlin-thon. We've been trying to do this for months, but the scheduling has not worked out right, but we're finally doing it. It's a movie marathon that you guys requested, and it's all films and television featuring Kyle McLaughlin. We're going to be watching the first four episodes of Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet, Justice League New Frontier, where he did the voice of Superman, The Flintstones, where he was the villain alongside Halle Berry of all people, and Dune, the extended cut. 12 hours of Kyle McLaughlin, streaming straight from the Nerdy House, with hosts and friends providing running commentary all day long, also eating delicious potluck food, perhaps even some Blue Velvet cake. That's happening this Saturday, May 25th, from noon to midnight. You can check out the event page, where we'll have our rough itinerary of what we're watching and when the specific shows are expected to start. So if you can, you should tune in to us live anytime you're available during that day if you want to hang out, and we'll be chatting and talking and watching some amazing films. That's all for me now. We're going to go to our James Bond microsode, but I'll be back to give some mad props to some awesome people who've supported the show. Welcome to Nerdy Show, a weekly podcast dedicated to every facet of nerddom, from comics and video games to science and technology. If it's geeky, we've got it covered. Thank you, Colin. That was really exciting.
Yeah, you like that?
This is a Nerdy Show microsode. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hi, I'm Colin.
And I'm Matt.
And now we're going to talk about James Bond, 007, and the multiple Bond theory. This episode comes courtesy of Trench 88, but with a little inspiration from Mr. Max Acree, who I can't remember the exact circumstance, but at some point he suggested this, I think on the forums, and I was like, oh man, you bastard, I want to do that so bad. I want to talk about James Bond with Matt Spill here.
And Matt's here.
He's here in the studio, which has never happened before.
And I'm here too.
I crossed three time zones. We just be here for this conversation.
That's right. We got a weird space-time catastrophe happen, and we have Colin from Nashville and Matt from Los Angeles here in Orlando, Florida at the same time. And that's awesome.
Multiple personalities, multiple bonds.
That's right. Or are they?
So the James Bond, multiple Bond theory, it's pretty self-explanatory, as I'm sure you can imagine, dear listeners, what it's about. But, you know, we've had a lot of Bonds in our day. Connery, Lazenby, you know, Brosnan, the obvious one that I'm forgetting right now.
Moore,
that's the one.
Dalton.
And Dalton.
Mr. Daniel Craig.
Yep. There's been movie-to-movie continuity.
Right.
You know, we see George Lazenby as James Bond gets married and she dies at the end of the movie.
Spoilers. And Lazenby does not get enough credit, I gotta say.
Well, Honor Majesty's Secret Service doesn't get enough credit.
Okay.
That's my personal favorite.
Bond film.
Well, actually, maybe, you know, Lazenby for half that movie, his voice was being dubbed. Because as he was,
are you
when
fucking
he was,
kidding me?
Well, when he was Sir Hilary Bray,
like,
and he had to fake that he was a Scottish heraldry expert.
Oh.
It was actually the actor who was that he meets earlier in the movie that is Sir Hilary Bray, and he, you know, quote unquote, learns the accent or learns how to imitate him. But it's actually they were just dubbing him over,
so he couldn't do the accent.
That's hilarious.
Assumedly, or they just thought it would be a better idea.
Well, he was Australian. Is that true?
Lazenby was Australian.
Yep. Yeah.
Huh. Wife dies, and then the following film.
Roger Moore
goes to her grave, and also
it was a few films later.
It was in the opening
of For Your Eyes Only, which 1981, which actually they were doing to.
Oh really, man? You good?
Yeah,
this is why you're here, man.
Well, there was a lot to that opening sequence. There were some legal issues going on with Never Say Never Again being put into production.
Oh right,
because Kevin McClory had the rights due to, you know, Ian Fleming having fucked him over on
the Never Say Never Again Thunderball saga is something that we'll post a link to in this episode's page, because
yes,
we can't possibly get into it. It's too nuanced and complicated.
So Never Say Never Again was going into production, and with Connery, so MGM kind of wanted to make a statement that like they are still the Bond franchise. So part of that was referencing earlier Bond moments, such as visiting his wife's grave.
Mm-hmm.
You establish that this Bond is the same Bond that was around for the Blofeld era. And then actually in that sequence, there is a man in, you know, bald man in a wheelchair with a cat.
Right. And he blows him up.
Yeah. Well, takes over the helicopter and tries to kill Bond.
Dumps him down a smokestack.
But they never refer to him or directly as Bond's former nemesis.
Mm.
So, you know, there's an in-joke there before he dumps him down the smokestack. Like he says, I'll buy you a delicatessen in stainless steel. There's some rumors that had something to do with the lawsuit that was going on.
Oh, yeah. I love the weirdness of that line.
Oh, it's so strange.
No one knows what it is.
Yeah, never explained. And they dump him down the smokestack as if to say, with or without Blofeld, it's still Bond. This is the James Bond franchise, Connery or not.
Short while later, License to Kill, Felix Leiter's getting married, like the millionth Felix Leiter that they've ever cast, who's changed races before.
Who actually was the only actor, or actually prior to the Daniel Craig era, he was the only Felix Leiter to play him twice, because he was also the Felix Leiter in Live and Let Die. But there were like three Leiters in between his performances. That was kind of weird.
What's his face? The guy who plays the happy-go-lucky CIA agent that replaces the Felix role in the Brosnan films.
Mm-hmm.
He was an arms dealer in
Living Daylights.
Yeah.
Only two movies prior to his appearance in Goldeneye.
Right. Totally weird. But anyway, so Felix says, to his bride-to-be. Oh, James was married once. And then Felix goes and, man, that movie is just a train wreck of bad things happening to people. You know, he gets his legs eaten off by a fucking shark.
And his wife raped and killed.
Yes.
His newlywed wife.
They were like, what can we do to spice James Bond up? Let's make it depressing. Super fucking depressing. That movie's so hard to watch.
Very young Benicio del Toro, who just played a henchman.
That's right.
He actually did a very good job.
A prominent henchman, though.
Yes.
Yes.
It wasn't like Sam Rockwell in Turtles. It was close, but there was a continuity. Mm-hmm. It was it was clearly there, and it was all clearly meant to be the same person.
Yeah.
And then the Daniel Craig thing happened. And they were like, oh, it's a reboot. But then M is still Judi Dench. So how does that work? Up until Skyfall, I felt like, oh, no, this is fine. They could all have been the same Bond up till now. And then the multiple Bond theory goes into effect. And this is just a new guy taking on the mantle of James Bond, which explains why there's been so many Felix Leiters. It's just a dummy name for a secret agent. No big. And then Skyfall fucked it all up.
So could you explain the multiple Bonds? It's basically that they are taking on the... It's just like he's taking on the number.
Yeah.
Different agents.
Yeah, like, I mean, there would be multiple Alex Trevelyans, 006. There'd be, you know, like, if there's multiple Felix Leiters, there's multiple James Bonds. They're not all happening at the same time.
Right.
And what's interesting about this is Matt and I had a very strange experience with this multiple Bond thing. It's something that we'd both talked about for a while. And then we finally saw the original Casino Royale, the comedy, Peter Sellers and Woody Allen. And in it, they actually utilize the multiple Bond theory. This is a 1960 film.
Really?
Like, 1960s.
67. Only 5 Bond films had come out by that point. So no, there was no other James Bonds at that point. It was still Connery.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There was nothing to prompt it. But in it, an elderly James Bond is approached by MI6 to come back to the field. And then M gets killed in this like terrorist act that's meant to be on James Bond. And James Bond, the old James Bond, becomes head of MI6. There's a hit out on him. So he says, well, the only way that I can protect myself is by making all my agents James Bond. So Woody Allen becomes James Bond and Peter Sellers becomes James Bond. And it descends into madness in one of the most amazing, surreal 1960s films of all time. If you want to have a good time and see some insane nonsense directing like you'll never see before, Casino Royale and Help. That's it, man.
it really, I mean, it's attacking some sort of weird, you know, the kind of 60s art cinema.
Yeah. Like it was actually meant to be a parody of 60s art cinema and inadvertently made the height of 60s art cinema.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It actually, and after us seeing this last year, it has some of my favorite sequences in film ever, actually.
Awesome. Awesome. I had to see this.
It's obviously really good.
And I believe it's on Netflix.
It's not for everybody, but okay. It's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so there's the multiple Bond theory again. But unfortunately, it's not a reality. I wanted to see a movie where Daniel Craig has to go and kill a James Bond who's gone rogue, but it's a frame up and it ends up with he finds like Brosnan or somebody operating in the shadows who finds him, and they fight and they have an uneasy truce and they got to get to the bottom of it. And it deals with all the continuities and everything. It ties it all up. And I was like, yeah, man, just having two James Bonds team up, that's like, that's not only awesome, but like money, pure money. No.
And then Skyfall happened.
Yeah, and Skyfall happened, which I actually really, I really like Skyfall.
I like Skyfall to a degree. But when I actually saw Skyfall after Matt, you saw it like what? Did you see it opening night?
A little bit before, and then the day after it came out. I actually saw it with the second time I saw it, they did a Q&A with Daniel Craig and Sam Mendes afterwards. That was kind of cool. But
because Matt lives in Los Angeles where things like that happen.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they should make a tour of that kind of thing. Like every movie has, you know, Q&A tours. But yeah, I wasn't the biggest fan of Skyfall because I felt that if you took out the obvious elements of like the Aston Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And well, pretty much, if you took out the Aston Martin, changed James's name,
right?
There's no way, like, I don't know what makes that a Bond movie at all.
Mm.
But I feel in another movie, if you Goldfinger, Spy Who Loved Me, even the Dalton movies, if you replaced even those two elements, you could still tell it was a James Bond movie.
Right.
Like, there was just, Skyfall was missing the element. It didn't mean it was a bad movie. I thought it was freaking gorgeous. But, like, I just did not enjoy it in that regard.
I mean, it definitely was a film that very transparently was going to be different from previous films.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I liked that it was shaking things up. And it even, man, up until the very end of the film, it acknowledged continuity. And I was like, oh, Aston Martin with the guns. It's happening.
At the same time, it abused continuity because he had this Aston Martin, but he'd never met Moneypenny before. He doesn't meet Moneypenny. Like, he doesn't find out Moneypenny's Moneypenny at the end of the film, whereas in Goldfinger, when he receives the Aston Martin, he's been not only with Moneypenny in the previous two films, but in you know, Dr. No from Rush with Love, and Dr. No, he clearly has known Moneypenny for a long time.
Right.
Well, yeah. And what I was hoping was that it wasn't saying that he was that James Bond, but that he, maybe, you know, he had some storied experience with this because he inherited some of his predecessor's gear or something like that. The thing that not only, I mean, I think as a film, it's a really, really good film and one of the most compelling Bond productions in years, even even though it went off the track of, you know, what one would expect from a Bond film just because of how intense it was, how dynamic the villain was, and so on. But it was utterly, completely fucked up by that last scene where Moneypenny says her name's Moneypenny and they end up in the in an office that's just like the one that he was in the, you know, the first movie.
Yeah, oh, yeah, when he throws the hat.
Yeah,
the
office, I mean, straight out of, you know, pretty much Dr. No through the end of the Roger Moore.
It reminds me of in the Ali G short film Spies, where he's like, I'm James Bond. James Bond. And it's like, you know, you don't need it to be spelled out for you. That would that movie, that that ending was for dumb people. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was both like, hey, old fans, we got all this stuff. You should be like, oh, I recognize that. Fuck. It's like at the end of the last Dark Knight film where it's like, my name's Robin. And it's like, we knew you were Robin. We knew you were fulfilling this Robin role. Don't say your fucking name's Robin. Robin's name isn't Robin, you cocksucker.
Yeah. Well, honestly, though, but I think that
it's
that
for stupid people.
But I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think the reason why they did that is because...
Hey, Colin, you're a field agent. I've been on the field with you. We've been through all kinds of stuff. What never got your name?
Oh yeah, well that's
I never
dumb.
Got your name.
Yes,
Colin.
Okay, sure, sure. How and yet we've had sex. Did right. they ha- they did they have sex?
Moneypenny?
Yeah.
No. I think it was insinuated that they didn't do.
Oh,
anything
they
that
did
night.
Not. No. But there was something going on before he found out. Clearly. Like yeah. Anyway, but regardless, I think the reason why they did that was because the whole Daniel Craig era of James Bond started to go on this deep dark path. And it started with Casino Royale. There was a lot more grit in Bond that didn't used to exist. Mm-hmm. And it was in the shitty movie that was afterwards, Quantum of Solace. That was horrible.
Actually, if you ever have like 5 hours,
yeah,
watch them back to back, like put it in immediately.
Yeah.
It carries on quite well.
Does it really?
Yeah, it carries the mood quite well.
It's strong in its way. By itself, it's, you know, you're like, well, this is a short film.
Right.
Yeah.
It's haphazard and there's not really much of a plot. But then as like a, it's kind of like a 0.5 Bond movie.
Right. You're right. But even still, what I'm saying is that like they started this gritty feel. And what I'm saying is that what I believe that ending to be, and Skyfall being the logical conclusion of that gritty going very, 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 very deeply dark. And then that ending of that film is them saying, okay, we've done this and now we're starting back over and we're going to have fun with Bond again. Which is what I think is happening.
But that was,
and
that
so
was
they're
the going
to go back to doing the Roger Moore like
but
ridiculous.
I don't think they're going to
making cars
one,
do you know?
They made a ton of money with this movie, so this next one's going to be just like Skyfall.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter.
And nobody wants the Roger Moore Bond films. They're amusing artifacts of their time.
Sure,
but no one wants that.
That's
but,
true.
But what's weird is two movies in a row have now tried to do this. Quantum of Solace's ending was very specific. It was actually the best part of the movie. This black and white sequence where he goes to try to, you know, whether he's going to, you know, get revenge on Ava Green's former lover.
Right.
That was, you know.
Yeah. Vesper.
Yeah. And.
Yeah. Because they killed the girl in the first in Casino Royale.
Yeah,
they killed
yeah.
the girl, which they haven't done since.
Yeah, I mean, Vesper died like that, though, in the book.
In the book. But I'm just saying, you know, they could have easily changed it.
So he, you know, he goes back for like whether he's going to get revenge or not. And then. The Daniel Craig Bond that had been set up in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace probably would have done it. But as he had learned through the course of those two movies, like, no. So he, you know, he decides not to kill the guy. He lets M and all them go in and arrest the guy.
Right.
And at the end, M does that. I mean, I think it's the best part of the movie when she says, you know, Bond, I need to know you're with me. And then he turns and he doesn't look at her. He looks at the camera and he says, I never left. And he was talking to the audience. He was like, the James Bond of yesterday, these two movies created what the Bond that we have known and loved always was. And then that's why they saved the gun barrels. The first time they did the official gun barrel in the Daniel Craig series was after he said, I never left, because it made Bond was supposed to become Bond there.
Mm.
Then Skyfall comes out and it's like, it's the end of his career. And it's like, he never was that fun loving Bond, or at least they hinted that he had been, but for over a whole career, because it's very specific in Skyfall. He has now had an entire career.
Right.
He is, you know,
like,
he's they've been did,
like,
through.
Basically, like, those two movies were at the very beginning
and this is
and
now
this at the very end.
And what's funny is they hold your hand for so many stupid things in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then that part, which is actually quite important, it is inferred rather than spelled out. And that's maybe the most important thing they could have said specifically to the audience.
Yep. After having heard that Q&A with Sam Mendes, you hear him talking. He's very respectful of, he's the biggest fan of the first three Bond films. Like, he always talked about Dr. No from Rush with Love and Goldfinger. Up until, like, when I think about that whole Moneypenny introduction, if you actually think about, like, maybe the series as a sequence was Casino and Quantum, and then those three movies, and then Skyfall.
Mm.
It makes sense with the Aston Martin, and it makes sense with, you know, like, everything else. But then the Moneypenny, like, it's like, if there was a Moneypenny already there, like, it would have made more. So also the whole thing about introducing Ralph Fiennes' M as sort of, like, pretty much the M that's in, like, Dr. No and everything, which kills me again, because in GoldenEye, Judi Dench's M is introduced as a new person, specifically replacing the old M.
Right.
And so basically what we have is two separate continuities that don't necessarily make a lot of sense.
Nope.
And the thing that bugs me the most is, and this is true of a lot of things that's been happening these days with series that are trying to, like, connect with their prior versions and all that, they go part of the way, but they don't go all the way.
Right.
I guess this is a weird example, but my go-to example for this is The Muppets. They're like, oh, well, we had a television show and a movie, and there was the first Muppet film to acknowledge the actual career of the Muppets on television and not existing in their own, like, separate Muppetverse or whatnot. Yet they ignore some of it. They're like, oh, no, but that all stopped in the 1980s. That's why Kermit has the 1980s robot, and, you know, maybe Muppets Tonight never happened. And there are a bunch of forgettable films in the 90s and early 2000s that I would prefer to not have happened. But if you're going to acknowledge some of it, please acknowledge all of it.
Right.
They certainly had been quote unquote working.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, especially for, like, some of the generation that found it to be most enjoyable. I don't know. Like, Muppet Christmas Carol is, for instance, one of my favorite things about the Muppets. And, like, that's in, like, the sort of era that they said didn't exist in that movie.
Right.
You know, that, you know.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was lucrative. I mean, you know, Muppets Treasure Island didn't live up to expectations. And Muppets from Space is a train wreck that I loathe. And Muppets Wizard of Oz, the TV special, is one of the most haphazard IP accidents I've ever seen. But, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's what happens when you have an IP and you're like, oh, we'll acknowledge the old stuff, but we won't really go all the way.
Well, really what they're doing is it's just fan service.
Yeah, but
it's just like, oh my gosh, yes, and Martin, that's awesome. And then they blow it up and it's just fuck you.
It's fan service for the lowest common denominator who have an idea in their heads of what it is so they can connect with it and be like, oh my God, that guy's Robin. Oh shit. And then his name isn't Dick Grayson.
Right.
Yeah, and I get, you know, continuity. I mean, continuity is super important, and they pay people to maintain it, set.
Validates the quality of the storytelling.
Yeah, and I can understand maybe breaking a little bit if it enhances your story, but I don't see what any of that Moneypenny stuff, like, it's interesting, and, like, their relationship was kind of interesting in the movie. But once again, it's a weird setup, like, Moneypenny as a field agent. Like, it's not really something that has ever been thought of or discussed or whatever, and it didn't seem like she was ever in any, there was any point that it made sense for her to, well, I guess she did shoot James, and that made, you know, that kind of put her off the field service, so I guess that worked. But I don't know, like that last scene with them, I honestly think it was just not only in the movie to acknowledge the old saga, but it just looked good, like, as far as colors and like the shot was, and I feel like that's the only reason why a lot of Skyfall was in the movie. Like, honestly, there's a moment in the movie when James is following the assassin, I forget if Singapore or whatever Asian country it was.
Yeah,
and
that
sequence was gorgeous. And he follows him up the elevator, and the guy's setting up to shoot someone across the hall, or, you know, across to the other building. And he shoots the guy, and Bond lets it happen. Which, first of all, once again, not James.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, Bond wouldn't let that happen. Also, Bond wouldn't have let that guy die in the beginning.
Right.
That was never brought back. Who was that guy that got shot across the building? Like, and, you know, sometimes you can just see, like, oh, he's an assassin. He just does stuff. But it was specifically...
Well, he was getting killed for the purposes of the bag. I mean, he was employed by... What's his face?
Yeah, he was employed by Mr. Javier Bardem's character.
Mr. Blonde?
Yeah.
Javier Bardem did an amazing job.
He was a great actor. But once again, this movie was one where they talked about, we don't need agents like you anymore. We don't need people operating in the shadows. Them operating in the shadows created the bad guy of Javier Bardem.
Right.
So operating in the shadows actually wasn't good. And also, there's so many similarities to him, to specifically that plot line in The Dark Knight. Like, he disguises himself as a cop to get away. He purposely gets himself captured in order to wreak more havoc than, you know, normally has. you know, the whole like, want to see how I got these scars. It's like, want to see what M did. You know, he takes out the, you know, the teeth and everything. It's
weird. That's a weird comparison.
It's just they so many movies now, they see what Nolan has done to something that deserved that sort of treatment because that exists in Batman and has never existed before for James Bond. And for some reason, they're just like, let's try to do this. Like, I just didn't think it was a James Bond movie at all, just in name.
Why do we Skyfall James?
That Colin Peterson, that's the best way to summarize how I felt about Skyfall. And on its own, it's a great movie. It's one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it utilized IMAX technology better than any, you know, non-CG heavy movie I've ever seen. And, I mean, the locations were just some of the most, like, they were as gorgeous as most Bond movie locations, but not the type of locations that they would ever normally
pick. I can't
tell
you how awesome it was. I mean, I guess you probably know, but just to see for the first time ever, Great Britain represented as an exotic location in a Bond film. I mean, like the Scottish Moors were amazing. Mm-hmm. It looked so good. And it was like, finally, James Bond is in his element doing Bond stuff in the place where he fucking grew up. That's
since
absurd.
1967's Casino Royale. When they went to his manor in Scotland, it was really weird. That movie actually had a lot more similarities to 67's Casino Royale than you would ever think possible.
I can't really remember or the name of the actor who portrayed old James Bond in the original Casino Royale, but he was actually Ian Fleming's pick for James Bond.
Oh yeah, who was? It was David Niven, wasn't it?
Yes, it was David Niven. Mm-hmm. And David Niven is the only actor ever mentioned by name in a James Bond novel.
Interesting.
Everything about that film is several enigmas tied up in bacon. Psychedelic tie-dye bacon.
So where do you guys think that after Skyfall, I mean, I know that we've got the money and stuff like that, and the money's involved, and we, you know, this gritty Bond is what the audiences are really connecting to, but because, you know, everyone liked Batman and such, but where do you guys think, considering you're both truly true Bond aficionados, especially Matt, like where do you think it's going to go from here? Because they've completely run out of books, yes?
No, Fleming books, yes.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, there's Fleming short stories. They've borrowed a lot from the short stories, though.
I feel like, in a way, I don't know if they're going to do this, and I sincerely hope they don't, but there's definitely some agents at play in MGM or wherever who think that they can probably, you know, redo a classic. And I hope they don't. You know, I don't want.
Oh, so you're saying that they're going to remake like something like Doctor No?
Well, honestly, because Casino Royale was the first novel, I actually thought they might go back to Live and Let Die, which was the second novel.
Interesting.
And I actually think,
and you know what, they could, and it would be a completely different film.
Yes.
Because that book and that movie, not the same.
No, it would actually be closer to License to Kill than it would Roger Moore's Live and Let Die. They're actually sequenced, and also For Your Eyes Only. It's an action sequence kind of, but like the major like set piece sequence in that movie is in For Your Eyes Only. It's when they tie Bond and the girl to the end of the boat and drag them through the coral reef to make them bleed so the sharks come after them. That's actually in Live and Let Die. So that was actually very early in the Bond franchise, and they didn't do it until like the 11th film.
You know, I'm weirdly okay with, I will never stain the original Live and Let Die, which is my favorite Bond movie.
So good.
But it is what it is, and it is not the book. So if they did it, I'd be like, well, whatever. I might confuse everybody else, but I know what's up. So.
Well, you'd be upset if there wasn't a Baron Samedi, though.
No, I love Baron Samedi the way he is. And Scaramanga and all those cats. Like, they, you know, they're timeless, and they're trapped in that absurd recreation of the 1970s.
Yes. There's a reason why you played Baron Samedi all the time during the GoldenEye games.
I did until I realized that I had a
significant disadvantage by being so tall.
Well, because
the odd job was so cheap.
Well, the thing about playing Baron Samedi in the original GoldenEye, and fortunately not the case in the new GoldenEye, is you shoot the hat, you shoot the head. Uh-huh. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's like having an elongated head. It's playing with a severe handicap. It's not cool.
Headshot. Hat shot.
It is the exact opposite of playing odd job.
Hat shot.
So I don't know where they take it for sure. Daniel Craig does, this is something that people don't realize, but Daniel Craig does have more films he's on contract for.
Yeah.
There was a scandal recently, and I say scandal because with air quotes, because Tumblr is a palace of morons. And I love it for reposting pictures. When it involves things that should have fact checking, boy, people are like, oh man, look at this. And they reblog it and it's like, it's true. And I'm going to cry about it. No, there was some fucking fiasco over, they said the next James Bond can't be black. And
oh God,
it's the dumbest shit. There was apparently some black British actor who they spoke, who spoke to someone official about being James Bond. You know, they obviously didn't say yes because Daniel Craig's still under contract, but they're like, you know, they said, hey, it could happen. And then everything that was, you know, shared around the internet was, there's never going to be a black James Bond. They said he can't be black.
Wow. No, Daniel Craig's way too big. And honestly, what's really funny is that he was a weird choice for it to be Bond at the time because he wasn't an action star. He was a drama star when that came out. He's a very good dramatic actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what makes him a great Bond in franchise.
No, I mean,
prior to Casino Royale, though, he was, didn't see it, but Firewall with Harrison Ford, action movie.
Well, I mean, but he wasn't like considered to be an action star in the way that this is an action star. Like he was in costume dramas
James Bond been considered an action star before their 10 years James Bond?
Pierce Brosnan.
Well, Brosnan, I mean, it was Remington Steele on TV, and I know probably wasn't a lot of action per se on Remington Steele.
I'm sure they couldn't afford the action.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way.
Yeah, and Lazenby was a model.
Yeah.
But I do like Craig a lot, and I liked a lot of the acting in Skyfall, and every Bond is a very good job of being representative of what we kind of want in the times. Like, Craig is perfect for the Bond now. As Roger Moore, I mean, this, you know, mid-70s to mid-80s, I mean, you couldn't have, like, in my opinion, couldn't have asked for a better, sillier, for what people wanted in a movie, which is why those movies are so successful. I mean, the Moore movies, I mean, as far as inflation is concerned, they're still some of the most successful ever.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that when he expired hard. Unfortunately, that includes View to a Kill.
It's got redeemable elements.
The redeemable elements are simply names, but not actualities. Grace Jones, Christopher Walken, Duran Duran, thus ends the list.
And John Barry. He did, that was one of his best soundtracks, in my opinion.
Mm. Awesome.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening, guys.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yes.
Before we go.
Okay.
Who's your favorite Bond?
Oh, geez.
Who's your favorite Bond? Matt?
I mean, does this count the, like...
Counts all the Bonds.
But I mean, like, my favorite Bond actor or my favorite, like, actor. His movies encompassing, like, because it's sometimes, you know, you can't...
There's a lot of films in the series. There's a lot of things going on here. This is a very nuanced question.
Yeah. Okay. Who is your favorite actor that you believe, like similar to with Doctor who you felt did the character the most justice?
I mean, it's going to have to be Connery, but his movies aren't my favorite. I mean, there's a lot of freaking amazing ones. I mean, I wish they were more like From Russia with Love and Thunderball than anything. I just think the last two were just, you know, not as fun, but I mean, I think Connery did the best, you know.
Connery's run, his portrayal of James Bond, it can't be overstated how quality it is.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to check out the alternate universe where Timothy Dalton got more films because he was robbed. I love him.
Dalton's actually my favorite.
I love Living Daylights.
Yes.
And he deserved better than License to Kill. He deserved at least four films. He didn't get the chance he deserved. I think he could have been the greatest Bond if they let him get a chance to, like, you know, for the studio to figure out what they wanted from the films, because License to Kill is still a pretty goofy movie, but not a goofy movie. That's another movie. But anyway, it's still pretty goofy.
Future Microsoft.
it was just coming off of Roger Moore's run, and it couldn't have gotten sillier than that. So they had to kind of, they were weaning people off, and then they dove off the deep end with License to Kill. He could have been the best.
And he had a timing issue. It wasn't that they necessarily wanted to get rid of him. It was just 6 years between.
Right.
By the time they finally got the ball rolling on a contract again to make Bond movies. And it was just too late by that point. You can't hang on to someone for 6 years without a movie.
But, you know, it was the studio's fault for virtually killing the franchise with License to Kill. They did it in so many ways. I think people thought James Bond was supposed to be over, and it wasn't. They just made a movie that was like it was.
But then we would never have GoldenEye, which is
and you know, if you get suddenly presented after Dalton, I mean, I love Timothy Dalton too, but... You know, suddenly with a guy as good looking as Pierce Brosnan, because let's all admit that one. Like, he is the best looking Bond.
Yeah.
Like, he looks the part.
The absolute best choice for the time.
Yeah.
Like, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Well, he saved those. There was a reason nobody thought Die Another Day or World Is Not Enough were good movies. And, like, probably half the people thought Tomorrow Never Dies was a good movie. But Pierce Brosnan was still great in all four of them.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, and that's why people kept seeing them.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice when you have an actor.
I think we kept seeing him because we all wanted GoldenEye, because we all thought, well, why couldn't GoldenEye happen again?
It did, though. I mean, that's why, in my opinion, Casino Royale was this generation's GoldenEye, and actually, I mean, same director. I think Martin Campbell has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he adapted it, you know, his style again, just to a, you know, grittier element.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening, guys. This has been a Nerdy Show Microsode, where we talk about what you want us to talk about for 15 to 30 minutes. it varies on how much we're into it. And as you can tell, we're pretty into this. We could keep going. So if you would like a Microsode, all you got to do is push us over $100 mark for this month's support goal. You know, every 100, 200. If you're the person who does it, doesn't matter how much you support us with, you got a Microsode. In fact, we actually recorded so much that there's a little bit extra for those who support us this month. So if you want to shoot us a dollar or however much you want because you like the show and all the shows we put out on the network, well, you know what to do. Get some more James Bond up in you.
Thanks to the miracle of YouTube, there are a lot of great outtakes of different artists doing some of the classic Bond songs because they used to be written before they had a singer in mind.
Right, yeah.
So there's been a lot of super interesting, like, you know, alternate versions of You Only Live Twice and Thunderball.
I'd like to hear the Bono and the Edge version of Goldeneye.
Do you think they ever performed it?
Well, they had to have done a demo.
I assume so. I don't know. I've never heard that before. I wonder if they have it. It's cool. People have actually on YouTube, they've recut the title sequences for, you know, these alternate versions of the theme songs. It's actually kind of interesting.
Well, what are we going to play, Matt? Well, which
I don't know. I don't know. Well, actually, it's escaping me. I don't know.
Well, taking us out on this episode is whichever one of these things Matt thinks is the most awesome. Thanks for listening. Bye. I'm Cap.
Bye. I'm Colin.
And I'm Matt.
Hey guys, it's Cap again. The next Microsode coming up is about H.P. Lovecraft. But before we dive into the infinite darkness to be molested by the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep, well, I thought I should probably, you know, tell some people that they're awesome before my soul is devoured by gnashing teeth. Recently, two awesome people, two first-time supporters of the show, gave us some love and said some really kind things. The first is from Matthew Shoemaker. He says, "Here's some money for all the bandwidth I've used from downloading years' worth of episodes in the month I've known about this podcast." And that is awesome. That is truly awesome. It's always a little mind-blowing to hear that somebody likes us so much that they are ready to embrace the chaos that is everything we've put out since we started. Mad props to you, and I hope if your brain melts down, it's at least, like, cool and not totally debilitating, like the Flaming Carrot when he read too many comic books in one sitting and became a masked Avenger, something like that, rather than, you know, some kind of comatose state. And then we got a generous contribution from Anna Barich, who says, "This is just a drop in the bucket compared to what I feel I owe you for the awesome programming over the years, but it's a good start. Love the RPG episodes." So thank you so much to Anna and Matt. If you like what you heard, even the smallest contribution not only warms our silicone souls, but does help us greatly in fighting the fight against being able to pay our bills and keep putting out podcasts. We have to reach a monthly goal every month, and we also have stretch goals on occasion based on certain projects and so on, and anytime we go over the bare minimum, that's a very good thing for cool stuff we can do, so it's always welcome. And when you contribute any amount, we send you cool stuff in the mail. A selection of exclusive audio, from deleted scenes from role-playing podcasts to outtakes, exclusive images, stuff like that. And of course, there's always the chance that you could earn a Nerdy Show microscope. And for fans who know our shows better than we do, we recently launched a Nerdy Show Wiki to serve as a one-stop shop for all the various continuities that we have, both in-game and out-of-game. But we need your help to populate it. So if any of you lovely listeners fancy yourself some wiki-inging, well, there's a link at the top of this episode's page. You've heard enough from me. We're about to go into the H.P. Lovecraft microsode. And microsodes will return sooner rather than later. In the meantime, we got an action-packed block of stuff coming up, including us hosting panels at Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina, June 7th, 8th, and 9th, our coverage of E3 happening all E3 week long, June 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th, I believe. You can go to nerdyshow.com/E3 for more details on that. And if I've forgotten anything, well, you can definitely find out about it on the Nerdy Show forums, Facebook, and Twitter. Pick your poison, stay nerdy, and remember, one must never kill a cat in Ulfar.
Welcome to another episode of Nerdy Show. This is a Nerdy Show microsode where you, the listener, have generously supported Nerdy Show and told us what you want us to talk about for 15 to 30 minutes.
Yay! We love you! Woo, yay! Woo. You gave us money!
I'm Cap.
Hi, I'm Hex.
I'm Mike.
I'm Josh.
I'm Adam.
I'm John.
And I'm Doug.
We're here with most of Ghostbusters Resurrection.
Yay! Ghostbusters Resurrection! Yay! They're really cool. Yay, they gave us listeners. Yay! And
very handsome.
Super attractive.
Thanks to Viral Demon, we are going to talk to you about H.P. Lovecraft.
Yay! Viral Demon! Yay! Talking about Lovecraft! Yay!
Horrible nightmares.
Hooray!
It's actually a noble horror.
Actually a pretty appropriate subject considering who we've got talking today.
Exactly.
Yeah. Howard Phillips Lovecraft is his full name, and man, he was...
If you don't, Harry Potter.
if you don't know the man, he's one of the most prevalent horror/otherworldly authors of the time. He was buddies with the
Robert E. Howard
of Conan fame, and basically when it came to pulp magazines and the unknown, this mysterious, quiet banker looking fellow, he's
twisted.
Yeah, him and Nikola Tesla have kind of retroactively owned the 20th century in as far as like pop culture influence, relevance, yeah. and people who were not appreciated during their time, really. Cosmic horror is a term that's often given to the man, and the first time I was made aware of him was actually because of the early 90s John Carpenter film In the Mouth of Madness, starring Sam Neill.
Yeah.
And it's a good film. It's part of what I like to call the death throes of John Carpenter, which is that film and Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Both of which didn't perform as well as they would have liked, but were completely awesome. And it seems like after that, he used up all of his juice on it. In the Mouth of Madness basically reinterprets a lot of similar dark themes of H.P. Lovecraft. And the reason we've got the Ghostbusters here is that Lovecraft did in fact play a large part in creating the style of dark evil that the Ghostbusters interact with.
Indeed. I was just saying earlier to the guys like how Dan Aykroyd has gone on record as crediting H.P. Lovecraft as being a big inspiration for the type of baddies that the Ghostbusters would fight, not just even in the films, but also throughout the cartoon series as well. Like, I mean, I can't say the number of times I've like rewatched some of the films and you catch little things that have something to do with Lovecraft. Not like a direct reference, but clear inspiration from that.
Well, the Destroyer once took the form of a giant slore.
Exactly. That's a good example. It's like many schlubs and zools knew it was to be roasted in the depths of the slore that day, I could tell you.
It's very Lovecraftian.
Ivo Shandor, the architect who built the temple on top of a high rise in New York City with
obelisks and pyramids and inverted glass pyramids.
Geometry.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. And the terror dogs are slightly Lovecraftian in the way they look. And man, there's so much, like, just I don't even the pink ooze that reaches for people in the sewer system. I mean, there's so much
that it influences people directly and how they feel and think. And,
yeah.
In many ways, he devised a lot of the most profound modern horror tropes for things that are not just the, like, you know, the slasher film or the Dracula scenario, things that are like very, very otherworldly, but in a way tap into primal fears of mankind in a sort of an inexplicable way.
It's like the fear of the unseen, basically, because, again, like, Lovecraft's big thing is, like, Cthulhu is, like, the one thing that everyone knows. Like, he's never, like, the evil is never really seen in any of the Lovecraft stuff.
It's, and when it is, like, you can't describe it.
Yeah, when it is, like, there's no way to describe it, so you still don't know.
It's unless the word is cyclopean, because that's the one word that he uses to describe everything otherworldly.
My favorite story by Lovecraft actually has nothing to do with the Necronomicon, which is very rare, the case of Charles Dexter Ward. And it's just about this guy who returns back to his hometown, which is probably where all of them take place. It's from a reporter's point of view, as most of the stories are. He starts to act like his deceased grandfather after he inherits his grandfather's estate, and some crazy stuff happens. And it actually is one of the best and most solid stories he's ever told, with the strongest narrative, even though he prefers the most outside source he can get, where it's somebody reporting on the issue, or maybe, you know, somebody who had a dream of something that was going on.
Right. I've actually never read any of his Cthulhu literature at all, but I have read a huge portion of his work, and there's a lot out there. I think that I've settled on my favorite of what I've read so far being The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, which is this bizarre spectral journey of a man named Randolph Carter, who is more or less a reoccurring character in his writing, who can ascend to this sort of dream realm in between realities. It's this bizarre fictorial landscape of impossible vistas that's kind of drenched in antiquity, and many of the highest minds have ascended there or meditate into that place. And it's in there that he finds, like, the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep, which, you know, writhes beneath the surface, and the things that happen. It's like this it's almost like, what if a Tolkien-esque landscape was just, like, drenched in horror and dark jungles?
Creatures larger than the horizon that you're looking at.
one of the reoccurring, say, tropes/modern jokes about Lovecraft is that his writing just goes on and on and on. You get these descriptive sentences that last for a paragraph. And
it's mainly describing is how undescribable.
That's actually one of my biggest criticisms of Lovecraft, is I think that other authors take his ideas that he created and actually put a better spin on them. Whereas, like, obviously Alan Moore has done a really good job with The Courtyard and The Neonomicon, which you should definitely read if you have not, if you want to kind of get into that mindset.
Especially if you're a Lovecraft fan, you have to read those.
But I think more importantly is Robert E. Howard, who was friends with Lovecraft. A lot of the baddies in Conan, and basically Robert E. Howard invented sword and sorcery as a genre, but most of the, basically every time you see magic in Conan, it's evil. With the exception of, like, one priest, you know, who worships a deity who is benign. But a lot of these people are cultists who worship things that are basically cosmic horror. And even in the beginning, like, one of the first Conan books is the Phoenix on the Sword. And the first creature that he encounters, it tears apart, like, these people who are trying to assassinate King Conan. And he looks into its eyes and he gets a glimpse of an unknown landscape. And it's very Lovecraftian, but written in a way that's a little more poetic, and it kind of gets the point across a little better. So, like, Lovecraft is has huge ideas, but I don't think he really had the writing tools to get them across as well as others can.
Well, it's like that's an example of it bleeding over into other things. Like, I remember we were playing Marvel vs. Capcom. I was playing Marvel vs. Capcom 3 for the first time, and someone was playing a Shuma-Gorath. And I was just like, what the hell is this thing? You know, like, what is this goofy little eyeball bouncing around with legs around? You're like, oh, that's a Lovecraft thing or whatever. And it's a villain of
it's from Conan.
It's the thing. You're like, it's from Conan. Like, Conan? Why isn't Conan in the damn game? Like, that'd be amazing. And you're like, oh, but he's in it because he's also, like, a Doctor Strange villain. I'm like, he's in Doctor Strange and in Conan? What the hell? Like, this
Doctor Strange is incredibly Lovecrafty.
Yeah. Yes. But it's like, it seems that there's anything that borders on magic or dark, far into space, there's always a Lovecraftian touch to it, like an Event Horizon. Oh, Event Horizon has a ton of Lovecraftian stuff.
Lovecraft's work, in many ways, was the material that was needed to bridge sci-fi and fantasy in the realms of horror.
Yeah,
because his work is I mean, many of his ideas and his personal interests are very antiquated, and he's interested in all that old gothic sort of stuff. But maybe it was just based on when he was writing this in the early 20th century, but a lot of it expands well beyond this mortal coil into what can only be determined as the recesses of space, which are also this, you know, a dark matter fabric that bleeds in and out of existence. And it gets, it opens itself up to Dead Space, basically, well, and like, Event Horizon.
Like you said. Like, oh, something is like so, it's so horrific, it's undescribable. And
or just even the knowledge of it is enough to turn you into something other than human.
The thing that attracted me to the idea of like Lovecraftian-ish, you know, stories and monsters and things was that the idea of, it really, I guess I credit to Neonomicon, when it was just like, they whisper into someone's ear, and it was a courtyard.
That was a courtyard.
Yeah, it's just they whisper a single word of the ancient deep speak or whatever, and that's enough to drive you mad, and you have a flashback. But at the same time, you're like, oh my gosh, that's horrifying. But how could I have forgotten that? Because that is something that's so primal.
Yeah.
As a living creature on Earth, I should know what that is. Yeah. But it's so ancient, even I forgot about it. I think that psychologically, that makes you confront your own mortality in a weird backwards way, and that's what's terrifying. Where you're like, I'm insignificant and small, and oh my gosh, what is this going on? It's messing with my brain, and I can't even. And then you're dead. You go insane, and then you kill somebody. I
think we have to mention the Necronomicon, which is like one of his obviously his a recurring theme throughout not all of his stories, but a lot of them.
Right.
And I think like the obvious criticism of it, if it's so impossible to find and nobody knows about it, how come everybody knows about it?
Right.
Like, 'cause I remember I was reading In the Mountains of Madness, and these guys are like looking at these carvings on the wall, and they're like, oh, what is this? This reminds me of the thing I read years ago in the Necronomicon. And the other guy's like, I read that too. And you're like, oh, weird. We both end up in Antarctica. We both read the Necronomicon. It's like, there's... It has to be more common than the Bible, because most
like cultists just go door to door handing them out for free. It's like, hey, have you we're here spreading the word of the Necronomicon and Cthulhu. Would you like
to be, driven insane
most
today?
Correctly quote the Bible.
But these guys can recite the Necronomicon from memory and rise a demon or something else.
One of my favorite tropes in Lovecraft is the tragic hero, which is someone who is so convinced that what they're seeing can be explained scientifically, but they just can't cope with it. Well, and so usually, they keep fighting against the obvious. And
usually they experience a tragedy even before that, where it's like, oh, my brother died.
Right.
I'm going through his journal. What's this? What? Who did this to my brother? They drove him mad. Maybe that's the reason why he killed himself and smeared poo on the wall in the insane asylum. I must find the reason why. And then they go nuts too.
I think that's why I like the case of Charles Dexter Ward so much, is because if that happens, but it's from an outsider perspective. He watches somebody else go through that.
Yes, yes.
And then like tries to find out more about it, but doesn't get to the level where he's going to be driven insane by it. But you start to realize that there's a huge, bigger picture here that you're not privy to, but it all makes sense.
And that's part of the appeal of Lovecraft, is that there seems to be this monstrous amount of like existence that you're always just seeing a sliver of. Because if you saw any more, you fear reading it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go insane if he describes any more.
It's like that Die Fantasy video does a great job.
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
Oh man, God. That video.
I remember the first time you sat me down, you're like, you didn't say anything. You're like, Doug, like I just showed up. We were going to be writing something. And he's just like, before we begin, just watch this really quick. Presses play, and it's an animated music video. I'm just watching it.
And you're like, there's a bunch of teenagers at a pool.
Yeah, they're sneaking into like the pool of a local gym or something like that. And I'm like, and they're like, they're making out, like sipping little beers and stuff. And I'm like, okay,
what are you making me?
Yeah, and like they start, these kids start getting frisky, and I'm like, I'm getting a little uncomfortable here. This is like some weird, like you said, it's like some weird anime porn thing going on. And then all hell breaks loose. And if you haven't seen it, just go check it out. You should probably link to it on this web zone. But it's perfect Lovecraft like material, and as soon as it's over, you're like, oh my god, that kind of fucked with my head. But I want to see more animated Lovecraft stuff.
Yes,
like it was perfect, because even the like you get the outsider's perspective, because the narrative follows one girl in the same way, but as she sees these things happening, and none of them make sense. And then when at the end you see what happens to her, just from gaining the knowledge of it, and it's incredible. Like it's so
something that like the animation can pull off really well. That like, because there's been live action films that try and pay tribute to Lovecraft, and Hellboy is probably what I think the best Lovecraft movie, because there's been other ones like independent films.
I'm giving
like,
it to Prometheus.
Prometheus is pretty good, but I wouldn't call it a Lovecraft movie. Like, Crane has inspiration.
It's almost like scene by scene in the Mountains of Madness. Like,
but it's still, yeah, but you know.
I'm just a moment of silence for the Guillermo del Toro film that may never exist in the Mountains of Madness.
That's
meant
to
be a 3D rated R horror film where the darkness of the Cthulhu writhes out of the screen at you, and the depth of the Guillermo del Toro's vision was that the theater would become basically a picture frame into which you see the full depth of these dark vistas.
Right.
Man, that's a shame.
Yeah. Well, apparently he saw Prometheus and said, oh, now I can't make that movie because Prometheus had a scene that's straight out of In the Mountains of Madness or whatever.
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Like, Del Toro, you can still do it better.
All of my money
forever. He can just have my debit card.
Just from the barrels, like, it almost, like, everything in there seemed like a direct reference. Like, the barrels where the black
the
sludge
goo
is
or whatever,
kept.
Yeah.
Like, those are the old ones.
The same from, shape as
exactly.
That. Yeah,
those
yeah.
are the old ones.
Well, in evaluating Mountains of Madness, can you better understand Prometheus?
I mean, I didn't really have a problem with Prometheus, but in the sense that, like, you these creators, in the sense, almost become like the old ones in that you don't know what their machinations are, you don't know what their original purpose was, but it's so far beyond what you can understand. Like, everything seems foreign to you. Like,
well, the reason why I hesitated to say that Prometheus is like Lovecraft, because it felt like they took a story and said, let's put it in that universe and in those rooms and have the same imagery, but not have it be connected to a Lovecraft story, if that makes any sense.
Well, I mean, Lovecraft deviated from the Necronomicon and stuff like that. Like, the Mountains of Madness, if I remember correctly, had nothing to do with Cthulhu. Like, it had the Shoggoths and the old ones, but, you know, it's not really, like, I guess it's part of the Cthulhu mythos because all of those exist in the same pantheon in other places.
From what I understand, calling them the
hierarchy of the old ones.
Well, like, people call it the Cthulhu mythos because Cthulhu is the most popular character, even though he's not the biggest, most powerful, or baddest.
Right. The one that makes the most prevalent, like, somebody sees it and it's a big deal, is Dagon. Like, like some guy washes up on an island that isn't an island. You know what I mean? It's.
Have you guys played the board game Arkham Horror?
No, yeah. We actually have a friend of mine has been trying to get us to play it for a long time, and I'm very excited to play it because he laid out the board and I saw how amazing it looks. I'm like, this looks awesome. Like,
the whole point of the game is that a dark one is rising and you are racing to stop it. Yet it is so easy to dick each other over that you just want to do that. Until the dark one rises, and then you're like,
why did we do that?
I regret all my life decisions. And mixed in the deck is one dark one that you flip it over. Oh, he's unbeatable. You lose.
It sounds complicated. You're like, yeah, we went. Nope. And then last second,
it's like, it sounds complicated, but it sounds like an amazing
crazy
afternoon.
At the beginning. We've just
like,
been imagining all of this.
It's maybe even more than an afternoon as well.
Yeah, that's what I heard too. Because like my buddy, he had like these expansion packs where it's like you unfold the board and it's like a huge size of a table, and then you're like, oh man, yeah, this is really great. And now you go into the Shadowlands, and then a whole new board opens up that you can literally connect them to that takes up like two dining room tables. It's amazing. But
are you guys familiar with Edmund Burke and his novel? Well, it's not a novel. It's his text, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and Beautiful.
Oh, I'm very familiar. No,
yeah,
I've never
figure the answer is no.
Good old Edmund Burke. Yes. This is we're talking about the one of Oxford.
This is an 18th century text. And what it does is his ideas about what he calls the sublime and the beautiful are basically, it dissects what fills us as humans with awe and terror. And it was the first time that anyone had ever taken apart our own sensations in those regards. And it's basically kind of a how-to guide being that it was written in the 18th century, it's very difficult to read now, but it's a how-to guide of how to present things that are incomprehensibly beautiful or things that are incomprehensibly terrifying or simply things that would leave you awestruck, which he calls sublime. And it's definitely a source for Lovecraft to begin with. Now, it's something that when people are dissecting Gothic literature, they will often turn to as an example of like whether an author knew about this text or not, why they would write what they did.
Like Frankenstein?
Exactly. But in many ways, what's commonly associated as Gothic texts are so much more pedestrian than the lofty concepts of what happens in Lovecraft's books. Even things like Frankenstein, which was, you know, like a reanimated flesh and so on, that was a very new idea in its own way and not pedestrian in the least, yet it was so much more...
grounded.
It was totally grounded by comparison. So this is, if you guys want to really dig back into what makes Lovecraft's work, this is a good place to go to. And like I said, it's a very difficult read, but definitely interesting for presenting. Like when you think of like a massive hall that extends onward, and there's columns that have show great symmetry, and the lighting starts to fade in the background, and this just picks apart the human experience of these massive things that we can't fully see. And,
as a GM of a Ghostbusters game, I think that's required reading for me now.
Oh, God.
Speaking of required reading, though, if you guys have read, like, if anybody listening has read...
Yeah, I want to do, in this episode, I want each of us who've read Lovecraft to give out at least one recommendation.
I loved Rats in the Walls. That was the first one I read, and it still stuck with me the most. It just messed with my head so much.
I think the closest thing I've read is probably the Neonomicon was actually really, really good. Like, I picked it up and I just didn't want to stop reading.
And the Courtyard? You read The Courtyard as well?
Yeah, The Courtyard is in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's all, like, all the same.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
okay.
It's,
the Courtyard is now part of, like, the preface.
I got you.
Yeah,
okay,
Josh
cool.
got it for me for my birthday. And it starts with The Courtyard and just goes from there.
Right, okay.
I would recommend anybody who's read Lovecraft and enjoys that kind of otherworldly horror to definitely read Conan. Don't let anything deter you.
The movies are not like it. Yeah,
nothing
at all.
Like it. Like The Phoenix on the Sword. To the Frost Giant's daughter.
If the text intimidates you, go to a comic shop and buy the comic books they have there.
The Dark Horse Conan comics from the last 10 years are, for the most part, brilliant.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And I highly recommend it because Robert E. Howard and Lovecraft were very good friends, and there is a lot of spillover, but in ways you're not expecting. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it.
I can ditto that one because I've been reading the comics and they're awesome. Like,
I guess my experience with Lovecraft is incredibly limited. I've read all of the Conan comics. Josh sent them to me, and they're ridiculously good. Aside from that, the only thing I really know Lovecraftian is, what is it, Robaz's Call of Cthulhu playthrough? That's about it. I don't know. That
plug Robaz.
That killed me. It was so good. It's funny. I love that guy.
Also, getting back to the idea of, like, the Gothic horror and the ideas of, like, the sublime and, you know, pure terror and pure different emotions, that kind of gave me like a Clive Barker feel, almost like when you're
talking about Hellraiser. Like totally, like Clive Barker, the Alien films in a lot of ways. I mean, Geiger's art in general.
Yeah.
Just the ideas of, I mean, trying to commune with things that are so beyond you, and, you know, getting these purest forms of these emotions.
Yeah,
they blend
called,
together so well that it's...
There's a book that Barker wrote called Weave World that really, like, dives headfirst into that, and that one's really, really good.
Spitting out my recommendations real quick before we move on. If you got time for a novella, definitely check out The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. It's a journey. It's a heck of a journey. But if you're doing a short story, try The Color Out of Space. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the Atomic Robo.
Oh, that's true.
which one was that? Was the...
Volume 3, I think
that
say.
Was Volume 3, yeah.
Have you guys heard about H.P. Lovecraft writing an advice column? H.P. Lovecraft answers your relationship questions?
No.
Oh, my God.
No.
Wasn't he... He had a lot of, like, weird sex problems, too.
And that's the rise of tentacle porn in Japan.
And that's where it came from. I recommend checking out a bunch of tentacle porn.
That's one of my favorite Lovecraft
movies.
Just
go rent all of Urutsuka Doji and have a good night.
Well, this is actually... It's actually a very recent modern thing. It's a spoof, but it's an advice column. Dear Howie, last week I received a you probably don't remember me note from a man I went to a school dance with 19 years ago. He's married and has 3 kids, but states he is not happy. What should I do? Concerned lady. Dear concerned lady, although humankind has a yearning towards whatever is redolent of mystery and allurement, it is well then certain lacunae in our knowledge should remain forever unfilled. Your shadowy correspondence mention of the ill-regarded numbers 19 and 3 calls an unutterable experiment performed on sicklebacks by the Swedish ichthyologist Degard. I dare not describe his observations, but he concluded that the longer we can remain innocent of our place in the cosmos, the better it must augur for our mental integrity. He came to understand that there was more meaning than is commonly supposed in the nebulous half-inscriptions found on abandoned wharves, while who knows what malign significance underlies the latest findings on the growth of angiosperms or the cycle of the solar spots. What of the transgalactic pulsings have cost more than one astronomer his powers of reasoning? I have heard it whispered
that in the imprints found on Degard's pillow towards the end resembled the fronds of a kind of bracken previously unknown to botany. The muffled chattering sounds from my roof impel me to hasten to conclude. Yours most cordially and sincerely, H.P. Lovecraft.
Well, that's not me. What is?
There's a whole series of them. I'll link them on this episode's page.
I guess a good question is Slenderman tied to the Cthulhu mythos, or is, was, do you think that was inspired by Lovecraftian horror?
I want to say a little bit.
I think its origin, like, it isn't. It's very plain, like, oh, I just put somebody standing with children, and it's just creepy, it's an old photo. But then the more that people try to delve...
People that added to it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or rather, not added to it, exactly. Because yeah, exactly. It's so unknown and so...
And yeah. I love I think the best thing done with Slender Man in that thread where it was created on Something Awful is are the wood cuttings.
Yes. Like the old German wood cuttings.
Like the 16th century wood cuttings of it. And that seems very... I don't even want to say Lovecraftian. It's almost just... I don't know, classic horror story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, again, my Lovecraft knowledge is limited. The only thing I can think of recently that I saw that could be Lovecraftian was that movie coming out this summer, Pacific Rim. The monsters seem very Lovecraftian.
A little bit, but that's
a little bit horror. They're very much like kaiju, like straight up.
Yeah,
they do. It's just, like I said, my knowledge is super limited on it.
I mean, it's very close because, again, we're talking about, like, you know, like ancient, like, creatures, like, at the bottom of the sea.
From another dimension.
From another dimension.
Or from another time altogether.
Yeah. Or, yeah,
a forgotten time.
Or some combination that's beyond our understanding anyway. Yeah.
Which, in itself, that sounds very, you know, Lovecraftian. Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things about some Cthulhu mythos Lovecraft stories is when Nyarlathotep directly interacts with the humans, everything else is so outside of our knowledge. Like, you know, he'll describe Yog-Sothoth, the goat with 1,000 young, and all these horrible things. But I think even in the dream, is it in the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, he shows up to the main character, like, with a bunch of fluted goblins, and they play, and he describes to him a few things.
I believe so. I mean, like, there's actually, like, a direct confrontation with, it's been many years, but he Randolph Carter finds himself in this incomprehensible underworld climbing stairs that were meant for giants, and is in this chamber with Nyarlathotep, like, underneath the world. And some very dark stuff happens in there, and that does sound, the goblins with flutes does ring a bell.
Is that the one where they turn you into a living mummy corpse, where, like, they suck all the fluids out of you, but you're, like, so you're basically a mummy, like, you've been drained of all fluids and everything, but you are still conscious of everything that's happening?
No, but that
the
actually...
Because you're talking about the giant steps that lead down into the thing under the... That sounded exactly like what that was.
There's I think you're almost referring to the Charles Dextrin Ward thing, but that also brings up Clive Barker. The first Hellraiser is somewhat Lovecraftian because, you know, the creatures from that you're unaware of, horrors and things like that, the with the Cenobites.
Puzzle blocks.
But the second one, more over anything,
right.
is when they go to, I forget what they even call it, it's basically hell, but it's not really, but it's a giant maze of cyclopean dimensions with non-Euclidean geometry. And the Leviathan is actually just a giant diamond-shaped pillar that spins with a spotlight. And, like, when the light falls over you, you see horrors, and like, it's so Lovecraftian. And then a doctor who's been, he's a horrible person, he's been experimenting on mental patients, you know, in horrible ways.
Basically a Mengele.
Exactly. Like, they're walking along the top of the maze. He gets shoved into a giant box that changes his body fluids and drags him down. And it's the most Lovecraftian moment in the entire part. It turns him into a Cenobite, and he screams all the way down. When he comes back up, his skin's blue, and he has this look of awe on his face, and he just comes out and says, "And to think I hesitated."
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone remember that old thriller called The Others movie. Like, I think sometime in the mid to late 90s it came out, and it was about these three point of view characters who they had these reoccurring nightmares and whatnot.
Nicole Kidman, right?
I don't know if she was in it. It was something. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're talking about? Is it Nicole Kidman and the two kids or whatever?
They get taken, and they put these. They eventually find these things that have been shoved into their arm and whatnot, and the others come back and they collect them, and you rarely ever see them. And, like, I mean, like I said, everything. I mean, that also strikes me as something very, because at the very end of the movie, you see her in that other very dark, very weird, twisted dimension where the others are, like, harvesting people. It's super freaky and whatnot.
I mean, I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't mention the obvious references. Reanimator is
Reanimator,
yeah, is like basically this weird
it's a modern day Frankenstein
grindhouse adaptation of Lovecraft stuff.
Yeah,
and then, the original story is not.
Yeah. And then Evil Dead directly references the Necronomicon.
And Phantasm doesn't really directly reference Lovecraft, but the first film especially does have a very Lovecraftian feel to it.
When they put their hand on the tuning posts and they see into the land of the dwarves.
Yeah.
No pun intended. We could just say it bleeds over to many different things. Yeah. Like, it's in many different movies, many different books, comic books, video games. I mean, we didn't hardly mention the Call of Cthulhu video game. There's like a million video games that have Lovecraft.
You know, I never threw the Phantasm thing because there is the barrels, and that's like the old ones.
Yeah. Dude, Fallout 3, the Dunwich Building?
Dunwich Building in Fallout 3.
Oh, man. That was like explain that level when it's not part of the main quest or anything. It's just like, oh, stay away from the Dunwich Building. Oh, screw you, I'm going. And it's amazing. It's like it's its own video game.
And of course, like, that's when I decided I didn't want to be listening to the radio anymore. So I didn't get
shame on you.
I didn't get any happy music. And I walk in there, there's all these creepy noises and stuff that isn't in the rest of the game.
It's literally it's one of the scariest games I've ever played, even though it's just one side quest of Fallout. It was amazing.
We'll have links to where you can check out all these different stories and everything, pick them up on Amazon and whatnot on this episode's page. And if you want to talk to us more about Lovecraft, well, just hit us up in the forums. We'll make a thread for Lovecraft specifically. So this has been a Nerdy Show microsode. Thanks again to Viral Demon for suggesting it. It was a lot of fun.
The unseen horrors.
Thanks, Viral Demon, for wishing us to
have nightmares tonight
about unseen horrors.
Yeah, yeah. Thulu Tagan.
To take us out, we got in the Innsmouth Look by Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. They're a very interesting, definitely channel Lovecraft and Lovecraftian thoughts and monsters and whatnot. They're really cool.
Nerdy Show is a listener-supported podcast, and this episode is a direct result of that. So if you liked what you heard, you want to score a microsode, you want to put us to the test and see what we'll talk about, well, just check out our Nerdy Show support drives, and every $100 mark that we make for our month's quota, you will earn a microsode. You'll also get a bunch of cool perks in the mail for any amount that you send our way and support us. We exist because of you, and we are eternally grateful.
Yay.
Eternally.
Yay, that means forever. Yay.
Thanks for listening. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Hex.
I'm Mike.
Bye, I'm Josh.
I'm Adam.
I'm John.
Bye, I'm Doug.
And now here's some Darkest of the Hillside Thickets.
The tide come in. She said a little swim.
This is Bartholomew Elfgar Gleeman. Thanks for listening to Nerdy Show. Nerdy Show is made possible by a comic shop, Nerdapalooza, and the generous support of listeners like you. As listener-supported entertainment, we rely on you to keep this and other shows on the Nerdy Show Network alive by telling a friend, rating and reviewing us on the iTunes, or making a contribution to our monthly support drive, or to your favorite Gleeman. Any size contribution gets you exclusive Nerdy Show audio and images and lets you participate in our monthly support drives. Just go to nerdyshow.com/support to chip in. For more episodes of Nerdy Show, Dungeons and Doritos, as well as other fine programming, community forums, videos, articles, and more, head on over to nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to all Nerdy Show Network podcasts via the iTunes Store. And for the latest news, follow us on all your favorite social networks. Tune in via Crystal.